The impeachment inquiry is exposing a rift between President Trump's supporters and certain members of the military.
He has an affinity, I think, for the Ukraine. He speaks Ukrainian. He came from the country, and he wants to make sure they're safe and free. I understand that.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Halloween, a look at military morale under the Trump administration. And the push to decriminalize sex work is gaining momentum nationwide.
Because you're arrested, that means you can't really get a good job. And being a trans woman, that means your options of jobs are very limited.
We'll hear from one sex worker on what legalization would mean to her. We start with impeachment up first. Washington, D.C. experienced a rare moment of unity Wednesday night. The Nationals beat the Houston Astros in Game 7 of the World Series, giving the team its first Major League Baseball championship. But on Capitol Hill, the mood is decidedly less celebratory.
On this vote, the yeas are 232. The nays are 196. The resolution is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
It's not fair to the President of the United States. It's not fair to the House of Representatives. And it's not fair to the American people.
This morning, the House passed a resolution that sets up concrete rules around its impeachment inquiry in a vote that fell almost entirely along party lines. The vote comes days after Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman testified to Congress about his concerns that President Trump pressured Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden. Vindman is the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council, and he told House impeachment investigators that the White House memo of the July call between Trump and the Ukrainian president omitted key words and phrases. Trump's allies immediately started questioning Vindman's loyalties and patriotism because his family fled Ukraine when he was 3 years old, like many Jewish refugees living in the then Soviet Republic.
Here we have a U.S. national security official who is advising Ukraine while working inside the White House, apparently against the president's interest, and usually they spoke in English.
He has an affinity, I think, for the Ukraine. He speaks Ukrainian. He came from the country, and he wants to make sure they're safe and free. I understand that.
That was Laura Ingraham on Fox News and former Representative Sean Duffy on CNN. But Vindman isn't the first military official to be attacked by President Trump or his supporters. Since taking office, the president has repeatedly lashed out against high-ranking military members and veterans who publicly disagree with him, including the late Senator John McCain. At the same time, current and former members of the military have become more vocal in their criticism of President Trump and his policy decisions, renewing a debate over if and when military officials should break their code of silence. Today, we'll take a look at morale in the military in the age of Trump. Joining me now are Missy Ryan, a reporter at The Washington Post covering the Pentagon, military issues, and national security, and William Arkin, an Army veteran, journalist, and author of more than a dozen books on the military. Missy, William, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
William, early in the Trump administration, and even when he was on the campaign trail, President Trump praised the military. He called them, quote, my generals. He stacked his cabinet with career military officials. Why was he so attracted to a strong military presence initially?
Well, I think that Donald Trump, in fact, started his candidacy for president being very critical of the generals. He actually said negative things about Colin Powell, and he said negative things about John McCain. He lambasted Obama's generals. In fact, as candidate, he got away with criticizing the American military in a way that I would think a normal candidate might not get away. Then when he became president, he obviously reached into the ranks of the military, retired military, James Mattis, as Secretary of Defense, John Kelly as Secretary of Homeland Security, Michael Flynn as his National Security Advisor. But he soon grew weary of all of them, or they grew weary of him. Donald Trump doesn't have good relationships with anyone, and it seems to me that the military is no exception. I'm not sure I would actually argue that they are an exception. There's lots of reasons why the military and Donald Trump are at loggerheads, but I don't particularly think it means that the military is one thing or that there is bad morale within the military.
Let's dig into a little bit of that, Missy, to William's point. I mean, this isn't the first time we've seen President Trump lash out at or criticize military members. Again, we mentioned John McCain. I recall thinking at that moment that, and I said this on CNN, that that was a turning point in his campaign, and he since was elected. So why do you think the president, Missy, is so publicly alienated certain members of the military?
Well, I think it's really a hallmark of Trump's presidency to lash out at a whole array of individuals and members of the military and high-profile retired and serving officers just happen to be among them. I don't see him especially singling out members of the military for criticism, but what makes it unusual when he does is that, you know, there has been a code in American political life to some extent, although there certainly are numerous exceptions that current and even often former military officers try to refrain from getting involved in partisan politics. Again, there have been a lot of high profile exceptions to that. But what Donald Trump is doing is seeming to, like he does with so many other things, sort of shrug off those norms. And what you're seeing because of that, and because of the policy actions that he's taken, because of his style, because of his erratic policy pronouncements, you're seeing this tension within the ranks about whether or not military officers have a duty, an ability to speak out when they disagree with the president. And I think that that's the tension that you're seeing within the current and the sort of former high profile military ranks. But, you know, I think that at the end of the day, most officers will acknowledge that, you know, President Trump was the elected civilian leader and he's in the White House and he's the commander in chief. So as long as it's not an order that is unlawful, that members of the military have a duty to carry out his orders.
William, so building on that, you mentioned earlier, I started talking a little bit about morale. A lot of the officials that are speaking up are either retired or high profile. What's your sense of what morale is like on the ground? I'm thinking with the military action that just happened in Syria, and we still have troops in Afghanistan and beyond.
Well, it's important that the listeners understand that the military is not one thing. There's a Washington military, and then in many ways, there's the rest of the military. The people who serve in Washington and are, who are in the fishbowl of political life are very different than those who are out there in the field. And I think the military is fundamentally mission-focused. It's fundamentally process-oriented. And so the consistency to do the mission, to soldier on, to do it in a way that is following the rules and the operational plans, you know, that's not being really interrupted out there in the field. And in a funny way, in a week in which Special Operations Forces killed Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, it shows that despite all of the turbulence that Donald Trump introduces in his, are we in Syria, are we out of Syria, and all of the process things that he violates, the clandestine forces, the special operations forces, the intelligence forces continue to operate. And that was the same even during the Obama administration. So as far as I see it, in my 40 years, I look at the military and I say to myself, yes, there is a split between the warriors and the non-warriors, and there is a split between the Washington military and the non-Washington military. And there are many who express alarm about Donald Trump. But to tell you the truth, when Barack Obama became president and he was talking about closing Guantanamo and getting out of Afghanistan and getting out of Iraq, there were as many people who I heard who were saying that he was a menace to national security as I hear today about Donald Trump.
Missy, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, because the president has been quite unconventional, if you will, and has broken protocol in many instances. I'm thinking most recently his press conference on the killing of al-Baghdadi. You know, the press conference, when you compare that to the way President Obama announced the death of bin Laden, you know, in less than 10 minutes, I believe, versus a press conference that many would describe as rambling, full of fantasy. There's no proof of the whimpering of a dog detail. For example, is the military cringing here when they see that the president is sort of breaking protocol by announcing things on Twitter, by having open-ended press conferences, by sort of not following the traditional rules?
Well, I do very much agree with William when he says that it's hard to make generalizations about an organization that has more than a million active duty members. And certainly there are things that Donald Trump has done for the military that are deeply appreciated, starting with restoring a larger budget for the military than it's had in a while. And, you know, that makes everybody happy in the Defense Department and the defense establishment. But there are definitely a number of things that I think cause grave concern. And I would start with, as you said, his style, his policy pronouncements that sometimes, you know, take 180 turns within days. There is concern that that creates an appearance of unreliability for America's partners. And then the second thing, and I think even larger and more far-reaching within the ranks, is the concern about what Trump's attitudes are towards the countries that are America's traditional defense allies. And this is when Trump questions the value of NATO, when he suggests that the United States might not abide by Article 5 of NATO, when he questions the need to keep forces in South Korea or Japan or Germany. And more recently, we saw this with the incident that you mentioned in Syria, when he abruptly announced that he was pulling U.S. forces from northern Syria. And the perception there, of course, was that the United States was abandoning Kurdish Syrian forces that had been fighting alongside the United States against the Islamic State. And so the idea that the United States, number one, is seen as a bad partner, and number two, actually might not be able to recruit partners, that the whole counterterrorism strategy, for example, is predicated on working with other countries and subnational groups. And so that those things are the things that I think are at the core of these concerns that we're seeing within the military.
Also, you mentioned recruitment, Missy. I mean, some of the critical recruits here are folks that are going to serve rank and file in the military. And William, you've written about the decline in those numbers. And of course, that's been happening for years, not just under this administration. But I wonder if you see some of the tensions that are playing out now between President Trump and military leaders, at least the high profile ones, the Washington military, as you call them, the sort of erratic behavior on pulling troops in and out and how he approaches foreign policy, whether or not that will have any effect on recruitment efforts overall?
Look, Donald Trump has been extremely disruptive in American society and, of course, within the institutions. And certainly one of the institutions that is both the most respected in polling and also the one that feels it is the flame keeper, if you will, with the traditions and the lineage is the U.S. military. The irony here, at a time when the military is getting an increased budget, at a time when the military is being given more leeway, where the rules of engagement in military operations are being loosened by Donald Trump, is that they can't make their recruitment goals. And we're not talking about something which is very big. The military needs about 100,000 18-year-olds every year in order to replenish its ranks. And out of some, I don't know, 20 million plus 18 to 24-year-olds in American society, it can't not even attract 100,000 people. And that's because of a lot of reasons. But the one that I think is most important is that America's youth is not behind the war on terrorism, is not behind the American military. And the American military as an institution is increasingly distanced from American society. And so when I think about Donald Trump, or I think about Barack Obama, or I think about the future, the real crisis is that the American public, the American society, is not with the American military. The American military is increasingly an institution out on its own.
William Arkin, Army veteran, author, and journalist, and Missy Ryan, reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks to you both for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The movement to decriminalize sex work has been getting a lot of national attention lately. Even presidential candidates have started taking a position on the controversial topic, and a few states are proposing bills that could decriminalize some forms of sex trade. Most recently, though, D.C. leaders heard from both advocates and opponents of a bill that, if passed, would make the district the only U.S. jurisdiction to decriminalize sex work outside of some counties in Nevada. I asked Anna North, a senior reporter at Vox, about all this, starting with exactly what decriminalization actually means in practice.
People mean a few different things when they talk about decriminalization, but typically sex workers' rights advocates, when they say that term, they really mean decriminalizing both the selling and the buying of sex. So we're talking really about repealing or changing laws against prostitution. One thing that's important to note is that none of these decriminalization efforts would make it legal to solicit an underage person for sex or to do sex trafficking where someone is non-consensually trafficked into sex work.
So when we think about the latest bill that's in D.C., where does that bill stand right now and what's it specifically asking for?
So the bill had a hearing earlier this month, which sort of put the issue into the news a little bit more. Currently, the bill is awaiting a vote. It's not clear when or if it will get one. But essentially, that bill is asking for decriminalization of sex work within the district.
Why D.C.? Do we know? Is this the first time D.C. has tried to make this push before?
D.C. has tried to make this push at least once before. It didn't work. But it's not the only place in the country where this is being tried. New York has made efforts to do this. There are bills proposed in Maine and Massachusetts, and I believe elsewhere too. So really, activists around the country are starting to push for this.
Internationally, have we seen efforts to do this?
Yes. So actually, New Zealand did decriminalize sex work a few years back and removing criminal penalties around selling and buying. And we have some research showing that in some ways, conditions for sex workers did improve. And New Zealand also found one concern that a lot of opponents of decriminalization have is that sex trafficking would increase. New Zealand did not find that to be the case.
So let's talk a little bit about why this is happening now. What's changed in the national conversation around sex work to make this these issues now part of policy?
You know, that's a great question. Folks have told me that it's really part of larger social justice movements. So things like Black Lives Matter and even the Women's March, you know, together, a lot of these broad-based social justice movements have really made people think about workers' rights, gender justice, racial justice, economic justice, all kind of together. And that has raised interest in things like sex workers' rights, which a lot of people say is a gender justice and a racial justice and an economic justice issue.
On the economic justice front, I mean, there are some folks who say this is going to lower the cost. I mean, if you decriminalize it, more people can do it, and it'll ultimately lower the cost and the price for these services. Is that something that people are thinking about, or are they thinking more about the safety and of the workers involved?
So I think a primary driver of a lot of interest in decriminalization among sex workers and sex workers' rights groups has been around safety and also just sort of working conditions. So right now, with sex work being illegal, people who do sex work are constantly exposed to police. So that means potential for police violence. It also means potential for arrest. You could go to jail. You could go to prison in some states. You could pay a fine. And then, of course, there's everything associated with being arrested. So having a record, having to go to court, which might mean you miss school, you miss childcare, you can't pay your bills, all these kinds of things. Sex workers say these are really interrupting their lives and having a real financial as well as, you know, emotional and health and all sorts of costs to them. And I think that's the primary driver around why they'd like to see this decriminalized.
So let's talk a little bit about the opposition to this, because I think this is a place where sex trafficking comes into the equation. And I'd love if you could sort of explain how that connection is being made by opponents to the bill, and if there are other things that people oppose when it comes to decriminalization.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things to note here. One is that you know, and I've found this to change a little over the years also. It used to be that there were a number of groups that really opposed, really wanted it to remain illegal both to sell sex and to buy sex. Now you see much more broad agreement around that it should not be criminal to sell sex. A lot of feminist groups say the same. A lot of anti-trafficking groups say the same. A lot of people want to remove penalties on the selling of sex. It's really the buying of sex that remains the sticking point for a lot of people, and I've seen two main objections. One is this sort of more conceptual objection saying if we make it legal primarily for men to buy sex, then we're saying it's okay to put a price on someone's body. Often people in this context are often talking about women, and they're saying that this sends a message that it's okay to put a price on a woman's body. Another is the idea that if we decriminalize the buying of sex, it will drive up demand and that will increase trafficking, or that this in some way might make it harder to fight trafficking. And so there are a variety of anti-trafficking groups that have opposed decriminalization for that reason.
When we look at the anti-sex trafficking groups, have they gained any traction in opposing these bills?
Yeah, there's been an interesting debate regarding the sort of trafficking piece of this. Sex workers' rights advocates have sort of pushed back and said, well, actually, these bills will make it easier to fight trafficking. They say that the people who are most likely to know about trafficking are sex workers themselves, that if they're working on the street or they're working somewhere, they see someone who's not there of their own volition, that they might be able to report that. But right now they can't, because if they report anything to the cops, they risk arrest. So that's the response there. But the anti-trafficking groups certainly have gotten attention, and a lot of them were at the hearing earlier this month in D.C. being very vocal about their position.
Is there a morality opposition here? Are there people who are saying, we just shouldn't do this because we're a Christian nation, or this is anti-woman or anti-man or anti-marriage or anything like that? Or does that not even factor into the equation anymore?
Certainly, there are plenty of groups who are against sex work whole cloth from a moral perspective. I think we might see that come into play a little more if decriminalization efforts happen more in purple or red states. Right now, we're seeing it in a lot of blue states and very blue cities within blue states. And so it tends to be a debate between, you know, say, feminist groups and anti-trafficking advocates and sex workers' rights advocates. If this starts to happen, you know, in places where the political climate is different, we're going to see a different argument.
And of course, we can't let you go without asking a question about the presidential candidates 2020. Have any of them so far taken a stance on sex work?
This has actually been really fascinating to me as a reporter, because I've covered this issue off and on for a long time. And I didn't necessarily expect to see candidates take a position on this, you know, leading into the 2020 election. But in fact, several haven't. The positions haven't been very detailed. But I will say that multiple candidates have said they're open to decriminalization, including Senators Warren and Sanders and Senator Harris, and I believe Senator Booker also. So a number of the candidates in this race have actually said, you know, they haven't said, here's my 10-point plan for decriminalization.
Not even Elizabeth Warren?
Not even Elizabeth Warren.
Okay.
But they have said they're open to it.
Anna North, senior reporter at Vox, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Now we're going to get one sex worker's perspective on those efforts. Monica Jones is a Black trans sex worker and advocate and the founder of the Outlaw Project.
As a young 21-year-old who just moved out of their grandparents' house, I was living in a studio apartment, sleeping on the couch, and that's all I had. And I met this guy at a bar, and I was going to hook up with him anyways, but offered money, I was like, well, I can get paid for this. And I got into it from right then and there.
Tell us how you went from doing sex work and then how you expanded into advocacy work and the kind of work you do today.
I think it's a continuation, because like sex work is work. And how I got into advocacy work, a friend of mine says like, wow, you're a really great person. You should try counseling. And what I heard was social work. And so I got into social work, but also I was like, during the same time, being a Black trans woman, realizing there's some serious issues with the way that the system of oppression is set up, and felt that I shouldn't be arrested for just surviving in this world, especially in a right-to-work state, and so became speaking about it then.
You said just recently, you said sex work is work.
It is.
Why did you say that? Why did you think that was an important distinction to make?
Because I feel that people don't understand that sex work is one of the oldest professions, and it's a legitimate form of work, and it's recognized in several countries as a legitimate form of work. And here in the U.S., it's not recognized, and what happened is that people are being arrested and goes into this mass incarceration system where our bodies are profited off because we're in prison because we have to survive.
So you've had contact with law enforcement, right? You've been arrested in the past. What have they been like for you generally?
They were violence, right? And so like any time that any person has, especially a Black trans woman, have interactions with the police, there's a power dynamic, there's misgendering happen. These issues impact trans women. So like my interaction with the police, misgendered, called a freak, court system set up in a face where even if you're going in there to fight the charge, you are already presumed guilty. And so the system is set up for you to plead guilty. And it's this revolving door out of the court systems. And like, especially in Arizona, where we have a minimal jail sentence for your first offense is 15 days, third offense is 30 days, then it goes up to a year in prison.
And so what's the long-term effect of that contact with law enforcement, of having essentially a criminal record, right? Because that goes on your record.
The long-term effect is, like, say if you want to get out of sex work and get a 9-to-5 job, as anyone would say, you can't, because everyone looks at your background. And, like, I have a degree in social work, and during my time of field placement, it was really hard for me to find a field placement because of my arrest. And if people want to understand, is that because you're arrested, that means you can't really get a good job. And being a trans woman, that means your options of jobs are very limited. And even like, hey, I get a job at McDonald's or a fast food joint, there I might face transphobia, sexual harassment, and everything else. And so sex work became like the best options for so many trans women and so many women and so many LGBT youth.
Well, let's talk a little bit about decriminalizing sex work and what the goals of that work are. What are you hoping to achieve when you're fighting to decriminalize sex work? And we'll talk about sex trafficking and how that plays into it in just a moment.
For decriminalization, what we're really hoping for, the long-term goal, is that it's recognized as a legitimate form of work, and that to minimize the harm of being arrested and having where, if you face violence from a client or someone else, you can go file a police report, and the police will have to follow up. And it's looked at as a legitimate form of work.
There are folks who also who want to push back against decriminalization and say that part of the reason why is because by making it not a crime, that it might encourage people to get involved in sex work, that it might move people to sex work rather than away from it. Does that matter? Should that matter, Monica, in your experience?
No, it does not matter, because, like, if you decriminalize it, it's a legit form of work. And it's all the right to choose to work, right? I think people have the right to work in the industry or in the business that they choose. And it should not be deterred because of anyone, spiritual our emotional belief about sex work.
In your personal experience, and when you look at sex workers as a whole, do you see differences in how law enforcement treats different kinds of sex workers? For example, being a Black trans woman versus being a white woman?
I think that's just society as a whole, especially just like having your access to privilege, right? And so the farther you up the totem pole, the less violence you may experience. But as Black trans women, being invisible and being Black, being trans, those are the things that impact us. And that's what makes us more susceptible to violence.
One other thing that, you know, we think about when we think about decriminalizing is, would it also open up avenues for healthcare without feeling like you're putting yourself in danger?
Having access to adequate healthcare systems is crucial, but also having agency over your own body, right? And so, like, not being told when to be tested and not have the testing forced upon you, but actually, like, hey, I need to get tested. What we see a lot is that condoms are used as evidence to prove that someone was sex working. And so, and that's basically like with street-based economy.
And would it make it easier for law enforcement to focus on things like sex trafficking if sex work were decriminalized? In other words, they wouldn't be looking for sex workers, but they'd be able to work more closely with sex workers in identifying people who are doing this work against their own will.
Yes, and I think who would know, who's trafficked, clients would know if someone's being trafficked. They can say, like, hey, I saw this girl and she looked like she was trafficked, or I saw this guy who looked like they were trafficked. And so making sure that people are safe to come forward and identify traffic victims, and making sure that traffic victims can come forward without fear of being arrested.
Are you hopeful that this is something that will happen at some point? I mean, as we know, the bill is making its way through Washington, D.C. right now.
Yes, because a lot of cities are going after decrim. And so I think that it's like this amazing thing where you might not see it in one city, but you might see it in some other city. Hopefully that sex work gets recognized as work.
Monica Jones is a Black trans sex worker and advocate and founder of the Outlaw Project. And that's our show for today. And if you don't already, make sure you follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. You can find me at Tanzina Vega. And of course, we're on Facebook and Instagram. Our team includes producers Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Andres O'Hara, Jivika Varma, Rob Gunther, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Joseph Gedeon. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. Our tech team is Claire McKean, Vince Fairchild, and Jay Cowett. They've played musical chairs at all the spots this week, and Jason Isaac gave us an assist as well. David Gable is our great pumpkin and administrative assistant, and Lita Halliwell is our intern. Deirdre Depke is our executive producer. Thank you so much for listening this and every week. We hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and happy Halloween.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.